Greetings, all your 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, a number of topics today, both political and economic. The first, I'm going to offer a few major election takeaways, post-election takeaways. I want to discuss some of the major developments in the wake here of the election 10 days ago. And then related to that, I want to talk about the four decision points that Trump must now face, four dates, if he wants to challenge and overturn this election. And of course, it's looking increasingly unlikely he's going to be able to do so. But if he does so, he's got four decision points coming up in December. And we'll see, you know, what happens between really December 8th. And December 23rd. That's the key time frame. And that's why he's engaging in all these legal challenges and so forth. But it doesn't look good for him, because just today, major CEOs and major corporations are getting together and going to put pressure on him to pull out, I'm sure. That's the sign that the business and the capitalists have turned against him. And enough is enough. You know, they like Biden, and we'll talk about why. And that will be it. But there's still a long shot here that he could pull off something, although increasingly unlikely. It will take some kind of a October surprise in December to do so. That might be in the works. We'll talk about that. But anyway, the major thrust of today's show will be the takeaways and Trump's four decision points, actual dates. I do also want to say something about the firings at the Defense Department Intelligence Agency. What does that signify? What's behind the Supreme Court and its upcoming decision on the Affordable Care Act? A comment or two about the Pfizer's vaccine announcement. Final comment, I guess, on the China-U.S. trade war 1 year after now. And then if we have time, a first look at Bidenomics. You know, what will Biden's economic program look like? And how it's important to distinguish between campaign statements, you know, over the past year, his program and whatever, and the reality of once these guys get in office, what they do. And we can see where he's going because of his appointments. You know, he'll start making appointments immediately to cabinet and other positions. And we'll talk about, you know, who are the likely candidates. I'll make some predictions for the likely candidates or the likely selections by Trump here for the, you know, the big departments: State, Treasury, Defense. Right. Let's jump into it. Let's talk about election takeaways. What can we say about this election and where it's going? Well, you know, I think there are at least a half a dozen major takeaways. The first is that there was no blue wave. Yeah, we all know that. No blue wave. In fact, the Democrats lost 14 seats, it looks like, in the House. They're down to a narrow margin now from 232 to 218, I think it is. And they may lose a couple more. There's barely 10 seat difference between them and the Republicans. So, you know, Pelosi is going to have to be even more careful about what she proposes, which will dampen any real programs coming out of the House. It's even worse than the Senate, of course. Right now, it's 50 Republicans versus 48 Democrats. And yes, there's these two seats in Georgia that are going to have to run off, and that will be a real dogfight. I would predict that the vote will split there. So the Dems still will not have the Senate, and that has major, major implications McConnell will still run the show, and McConnell will simply resurrect what he did under 8 years under Obama, and that is slap down everything that comes his way. You know, the Senate will govern this country just as it did, especially under the last 4 years of Obama, but more of the same. And that means Biden will backtrack even further than he might otherwise have done on his programs and policies. And we'll have a renewal of a bipartisanship, you know? That's that Democrat bullshit, the bipartisanship, right? We got to get the Republicans to come on, so we have to reduce our proposals and so forth. In other words, McConnell will run the show, as he has been. Okay, so no blue wave, right? And by the way, I predicted back in November 2018, right after the election, I wrote a piece, read it on my blog, called Not a Victory by Any Means. I predicted that Pelosi's strategy to win a few marginal seats and a majority in the House in 2018, that, quote, suburban strategy, as they called it, would not work in a national election. And, of course, it hasn't worked, has it? No. So, you know, what was the suburban strategy? A focus on marginal districts that tend to swing Republican, Democrat, right? And, you know, construct a message targeting women and upper income professional, middle class professionals, former vets, independents, you know, that kind of strategy, and flip those margins instead of really trying to mobilize those who've given up. Over half of the country at the time given up on either party, most of which were working class kind of folks, you know, who don't see much to be offered there by either party, and they didn't vote. Instead of really mobilizing that group, you know, which to some extent Sanders thought he could, but his success there was limited. Instead of doing that, let's go after, you know, the Republican light folks, you know, and let's see what we can come up with to swing them back into our camp, right? That was you know, the strategy here in 2018. They thought it would be a blue wave. Nope, didn't happen. Quite the contrary, didn't happen. Even though they turned out 77 million now, isn't it, to vote against Trump. You know, I don't think it's so much that Biden beat Trump as Trump beat Trump. I think that was really it here, his failure to really deliver in the swing states, you know, up there in Michigan, Ohio, and Wisconsin, right? Pennsylvania failed to deliver what he said he would in jobs and so forth. Plus, you know, his constant practice of sticking his foot in his mouth, making it worse for himself. I think that hurt him too, him meaning Trump. So, you know, they swung those states back by a, you know, small margin, except for Michigan, pretty good margin Michigan. But, you know, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, those aren't massive victories there, but they are victories, no doubt. And, you know, why? Well, I think it's because black folks and Latinos organizing in the cities, particularly Pennsylvania and Detroit, places like that, Milwaukee, were able to bring out more minority votes, mobilize them, which, you know, was not really a Democratic strategy. And you can really see the success of that grassroots strategy in Georgia, right? Where the Democrats put very little money relative to some of the other wasted campaigns in the Senate, like going after McConnell in Kentucky. You know, what a waste of money, right? And other races there, they pumped record amount of money into Senate races in these red states that they had no chance of winning. You know, both in the Senate and in the House, the blue wave strategy was a flop, right? And yes, Biden wins, but he wins because Trump loses. All right. And it really was the grassroots mobilization in Georgia and in Latinos in Nevada and Arizona that really made the difference in this election. You know, that should be the message here. You know, grassroots to get people registered and get them to turn out to vote, you know, not throwing money at marginal pro-Republican districts and Senate races, you know, which was the grand strategy of the Democratic Party leadership and therefore of the corporate wing of that party. Right. If we just summarize what made the difference in this election, I really think it was, you know, the mobilizations at the grassroots in big cities, some big cities, and in Georgia and in the Southwest, and the flipping back again of those three states in the Northwest. That's the whole election, you see. That was it, right? But we still have 77 million vote for Biden and 72 million vote for Trump. Yes, there was no major disaffection from Trump. No. Trump's forces simply got outmobilized, you see, outmobilized by the grassroots and mostly minorities and working class folks changing their mind and coming out to vote again. That's how Trump lost. You know, he still has that base of over 70 million people, over half of whom really think that he won the election still. That's Trumpism, you see. Trumpism as a movement is not going away and may get even more intense. May, will, I predict, over the next 4 years. Okay. So, no blue wave, first takeaway. Second wave, takeaway, 72 million Trumpists, right? And that's going to have big implications for elections in 2022. You know, if Biden cannot pull off within the next 18 months a significant recovery of the economy and a real effort to deal with the problems and the issues that, you know, his political base really wants to be dealt with, if he fails in doing that, and the odds are he will fail because McConnell will make him fail, well, then watch a sweep again in 2022 midterms back to the Republicans in the House. Watch it. It will happen. He's got 18 months to do something. And, of course, he will have major opponents all along the way. Trump out there and his movement in the grassroots. And think they're extreme now. Wait until, you know, you get him out of office. McConnell in the Senate, and of course the Supreme Court, which is now stacked against them. You know, it's going to be very difficult in this triple crisis that the U.S. is facing, economic, you know, healthcare, and political. It's going to be very difficult for Biden to come up with a program, Democrats to come up with a program that really solves the issues. That's a major takeaway, I think, you know. The odds are against a resolution of the crises that we have over the next 18 months. Yeah. And if that happens, I think these three points of major opposition, McConnell in the Senate, you know, the Supreme Court, and Trump in the grassroots, are a major, major source of the continuing political crisis in this country that we're going to see, and economic. You know, a number of experts say that this situation with the COVID is not going away. Even when you get a distribution late next spring, probably it will take a general distribution of a virus vaccine, the effects of this economically are going to drag over. And under the best of conditions, you're not going to start to get a recovery until 2022. Yeah. So we'll see whether that happens. But I guess the second takeaway is Trump as a movement is as strong as ever. It's not going away. It's only been checked, you see, checked. And checked largely by the efforts of the grassroots, you know, ethnic minorities and working class in certain areas, big cities and so forth. They've checked Trump. They haven't defeated Trump. And you guaranteed on January 22nd, one day after, or 21st, one day after Trump leaves office, and likely now he will have to, then one day after, he's running for election in 2024. And you think he was extreme up to now. Watch. Right. Okay, so Bidenomics, we'll return to that somewhat here later in the show if we can. Third takeaway, Georgia. As I said, I think that's going to end up in a split of the two Senate seats there, which means the Democrats will not get control of the Senate, and McConnell will keep doing his dirty work for some time. Right? Fourth takeaway, it's pretty clear that Trump is engaged in a scorched earth strategy here as he is pushed out the door, scorched earth politically and economically. This guy is a street fighter. He's down and dirty, and he doesn't give a damn about any of the consequences of what he does. He just wants to win. It's all about himself, always has been, and he's gonna leave chaos in his wake as he walks out the door here, right? Economically and politically here. And of course, at the same time, COVID is third wave is worse than the second. It's twice, infection rate is twice that of the second, which was the July, August, which was twice that of March, April. We are back to March, April, and then some. And watch the death rate and the hospitalization rate and the hospitals overflow here in the next couple of months. Right? You know, and it's really shocking when you think about it. When you look at other countries like Australia, right, Taiwan, let alone China, right, South Korea, other places, virtually no infections, nothing going on. Why? Well, because in this country, you know, it's negligence. It's business over people. And we're going to keep this economy going and everybody do what they really want to do, right? This, they call it selfish individualism. I call it stupid individualism. And, you know, that's the reason. That's the reason it's so bad here. When you think about it, negligence on the political government realm and stupidity on the realm of individuals. You know, it's that 45 and above generation, you know, the Reagan coming of age generation, you know, who makes a fetish out of freedom, including insignificant acts like wearing a mask, you see. And of course, the politicians, the right-wing politicians, really fan that sentiment. You know, they feed them and fan them. Oh, that this is a question of your freedom, right? So scorched earth, that's the takeaway. I mean, that's obvious. Scorched earth strategy now. No blue wave. Trumpism, 70 million, still here continuing. No scorched earth policy, right? Trump still runs the Republican Party. That's the fourth takeaway. Still running that party. It's become his. It's not Republican. It's Trump-publican. Still running it, right? I mean, the politicians in that party are terrified as to what he could do because he controls that base still, see? And they're particularly terrified about if they come out and say, okay, go away, Trump, You know, we'll still have the Senate, we'll have the Supreme Court. You know, it's not all that bad for us, maybe for you, but not for us. You know, you should retire, and we're going to deal with Biden. Instead of saying that to him, right? They're worried. They're primarily worried about those two races in Georgia. At least McConnell is. That's why he hasn't come out against Trump. You know, Trump could scuttle that. He could scuttle that. And simply by turning loose his people against the established Republican politicos here. So they're all being quiet. And, of course, they're all worried that when they run for office again, you know, if they don't support Trump, let alone come out against him, then he'll just sick his right wingers on him, his Tea Party type plus, and they'll lose the primary. So their careers come first, and that's why they're sitting tight, saying, doing nothing, you know, even to the point that the CEOs now have to come into the show and put pressure on Trump, right? So he's terrorizing the party, too, Trump is. You know, he's firing people. He's threatening people. You know, if you come out against me, you're toast. And you better come out for me, or, you know, I'll think you may become toast. So they're terrorized, right? And that Trump terrorizing is going to continue, not just in the party, his party there. He's going to run it behind the scenes, but it's going to continue terrorizing U.S. democracy in the next 4 years as well. So Trump runs the party, very clear still, a takeaway. He may lose the election, but he hasn't lost his base. That's one of the advantages of convincing your base with all these lies for months that the election is rigged, you see. You don't lose, right? It was stolen from you. Another takeaway is, you know, what's going to happen with the Supreme Court with a solid 6-3 conservative, radical future here, right? Well, one thing, Biden will never stack the courts, never. That will never happen here, you know? There's a zip chance that the Democrats will even raise that, right? What will be the role of the Supreme Court here in the future in terms of politics? I predict that the Supreme Court, before the next election in 2024, will take up a case that will seriously, seriously reduce mail-in ballot voting. Seriously. You know, mail-in ballot votes in the last two elections were about 80, 90,000. This election, you know, we're looking at millions of mail-in ballot votes. So, 800, 900,000. Now we got multiple millions here. So they, you know, the Republicans know they got to stop that. They can't have mail-in. They can't make it easy for people to vote because then they lose, right? The writing's on the wall. You know, they've opposed a mail-in ballot and auto registration and everything. Just a few states like California and others are able to do that. But if the whole country has mail-in ballots, they're going to lose. So they're going to somehow find a way to get the Supreme Court to restrict mail-in ballot voting. Right. So those are the six takeaways. You know, just to reiterate here, no blue wave. Trumpism is still very strong and will get stronger. Georgia will not turn Democrat, control of the Senate. Trump is on a scorched earth campaign here, economic and politically. He still runs the Republican Party. And watch out for the 6-3 conservative radical control of the Supreme Court. You know, three pressure points here. The Sam McConnell Senate, the 6-3 Supreme Court, and Trump's movement about to get even more vehement and radical and extreme will all put pressure, three pressure points here on Biden, which will force him to assume a quote, bipartisan and minimalist economic and political strategy once he gets in office. Once he gets in office. Okay. Well, let's move on to this topic of these 4 points, right? 4 decision points for Trump. If Trump wants to somehow overturn the election and, or successfully challenge it, and it looks like his case is getting weaker and weaker by the day, there are 4 points in which he has to win somehow in order to reduce the number of Electoral College votes for Biden. We're going to see on November 20th here, Georgia will finish its head, its personal count, hand count here of the election, which will almost certainly give it to Biden here. But as far as the president, decision point, that's what's called the Safe Harbor Day deadline. And that's where states must certify their Electoral College votes and send it to the governor. Certify. In other words, resolve all the election vote count issues by December 8th. You know, if there's challenges and fraud claims and so forth, all that must be resolved before they send it to the governor. Now, if Trump's strategy is to delay with all these challenges and so forth, will they be able to, the states, to certify their Electoral College votes by December 8th? And if they do and they leave some issues unresolved, does that give Trump then an issue to take to the Supreme Court? Oh, they didn't resolve all their issues and they sent it anyway to their governor. You know, this is a violation of the whole process, right? That could happen. That's one milestone, you might say. December 8th, states certify the results of their elections. And then they send that certification to their governor, right? Okay, and the governor must certify, right? They got to resolve all their issues by December 8th, right? And the states then on December 14th send their results of their electors to their governor, right? On December 23rd, the governor then certifies, and that was a week later, almost 10 days later, and sends the results of the Electoral College in his state to Congress. Okay. So December 8th, they got to resolve it. December 14th, they got to send it to the governor. December 23rd, the governor then certifies. Now, what if you have outstanding issues, you know, that weren't resolved on December 8th? And nonetheless, even if it wasn't resolved, the, you know, Electoral College votes are sent to the governor on December 14th with big issues unresolved. Can the governor then not send the certification because it's not resolved? You see, you've got issues not resolved. Can the governor not send the Electoral College results and vote to Congress? Can the governor then determine who he wants to send as electors to Congress? Now, that's possible. That's possible. You see, because the Constitution says the states will decide how they're going to select their electors. The state legislatures will decide, you see. So if you have a state that has a Republican legislature and a Republican governor, right, where it voted narrowly for Biden, right, or perhaps not even narrowly, But the Republican state legislature and governor get together and say, oh, no, there's too many unresolved issues here with this Electoral College vote. We don't know who really won the Electoral College vote in our state because of all these issues. We're just going to have to select our own electors, Electoral College electors, and send it to Congress. I'm sure that was part of Trump's strategy, you see. And probably still is. He can get this thing turned over, even when the popular vote in the state was for Biden. Technically, he can. Politically, he can. Right? Which really should tell folks that, you know, it's not just the Electoral College that is an obstacle to real democracy. In other words, one person, one vote. No, not just the Electoral College. If the Electoral College is an obstacle to democracy fails, there is still another way that the politicians can prevent or thwart democracy even further. And that's the process I just described to you. Yeah. Oh, we've got democracy in this country. You not only don't vote for the president, right? Even when you do vote for the president, it might be overturned. Technically, could be. Now, on the 23rd of December, as I said, the governors send their electors to Congress. And on January 6th, Congress then makes the decision who is the president based upon the Electoral College, you know, or the electoral vote sent by the state politicians to Congress, you know. And if there's a dispute over that, whether to accept changed electors, if there's a dispute over that, then it goes to the House of Representatives, you see, the selection of the president. Now, here's another obstacle to the popular will. Under the Constitution, each state, if it goes to the House of Representatives, each state gets one vote for the president. If this is thrown into the House, one vote. Now you got 29 red states and 22, whatever, you know, the totals there blue states, right? And I think Washington, D.C. gets three electoral votes. Right, so there's 538. Yeah. So, okay, one vote each. And if there are more Republican pro-Trump states, you know, then by that I mean state legislatures and governors. By that, what do you get? You get Trump winning in the House of Representatives. If it goes to the House, Trump will win. Mm. Now, that's not the most likely general scenario from December 8th to January 6th, but it is a possible scenario. It is a possible scenario. And that's why you see, the globalist wing of the capitalist class of this country, the Biden wing right now, right, doing everything they can to freeze Trump out. He doesn't get much coverage anymore, does he? No, they're not paying attention to him. And they're, the Facebook Twitter are refusing to go with some of his stuff. He can't push it. You know, he can't push his message the way he did before. He's getting squeezed out by the capitalist media. Very true. Right? He's even got a feud going with Fox News. Right? And you see his group, you know, his supporters turning to other social media like Parler. And some of the others, Breitbart, Parler's the latest, instead of Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and so forth, right? He's getting squeezed, and they want to push him out before he has a chance to maybe, because he's terrorizing his party, and that's a big whip he's got to force state legislatures and governors, Republican, to maybe change their electors that they sent to Congress. Yeah, it's a big whip. if they are opportunists, which of course they all are. So they're trying to push him out, you know, premature announcements of all kinds, premature congratulations from abroad, trying to make the whole situation look like, you know, Biden won. You know, you don't really know until Electoral College meets on the 14th of December. You know, over a month away. He can do a lot of damage in a month, right? But he's losing that fight. He's losing the public opinion fight, except with his base, and they're squeezing him out. Well, that only encourages him to engage in even a more severe scorched earth policy in the meantime here, right? Now, he'll continue mobilizing his base here for the next elections, right? And the whole thing maybe of creating scorched earth and chaos might be for him to increase his bargaining chip, you know, with the rest of the political class here, to leave him alone and let him still be a political functionary after the election. In other words, drop your case against my taxes, right? And all the other things, you know, back off if you want me to leave here, right? So intensifying chaos helps that. Domestic chaos, I mean, that's why he's not doing a damn thing about COVID, right? You're not doing anything about COVID. The more chaos, the better, right? Economic chaos. Now, which is about to deepen, by the way, all the signs are now quickly turning negative. Not all, but most here. You know, you hear a lot about, oh, the U.S. economy is okay. It's doing all right. Manufacturing is up. Yeah. Well, manufacturing is only 11% of the total GDP of the economy. And yes, it's recovered. It never really shut down, most of it. It's recovered. But, you know, 80% of the economy is services. And they're still in a deep funk. And now we've got, you know, the $600 supplemental unemployment benefit has been gone for weeks, months now. Look, you know, what happened was the CARES Act put a lot of money in people's pockets, put a lot of money in their pockets, and they were able to survive over the summer with that $600 and the checks and so forth, right? And their savings went way up in many cases. And, you know, since the end of the $600 and the other measures, the PPP and so forth, right, they've been living off of that excess savings and debt. Right? They had extra income for 2 or 3 months, and that kept the economy from crashing even more. The economy opened up, especially in the South and Midwest. Oh, you know, that hardly shut down at all, maybe 2-3 weeks. And then they started to open up in early May, like in Florida and other places. Now they pay a price for that, you know, with COVID. But they opened up. They got the benefits of the stimulus in March, April. They got the benefits, and they got the benefit of keeping their jobs, reopened up. So they had accumulated quite a bit of, you know, cushion for spending. You know, in the third quarter, they did spend some of that. But now that extra cushion has worn off. The unemployment benefits and stimulus have worn off, and the excess savings they had compiled is gone. Now they're living off of debt, right? And now the crunch is really starting to feel here with no further stimulus. Now it's coming. Now it's coming. And, you know, the red states, the Trump states, did not hurt as economically as severely as the blue states, which is another reason why, you know, for months here, McConnell didn't want to allow any further stimulus, you know, because the red states weren't hurting that much and his big corporate buddies were doing great. You know, watch the stock market. They were doing great. So, you know, why should he agree to help bail out the blue states before the election? That was the main reason why he was against it, right? But now they're running out of it. Now they're running out of the cushion here. And latest I saw was in September, 100,000 small businesses permanently closed. 100,000? That was as of September. How many now? Double that, probably. Triple that. We're going to see millions small businesses closed by next spring. Millions. Now, there's all jobs there, too. That's going to be gone. They're going to be gone. Rent evictions are escalating, right? And come December 31st, all those contingent workers, you know, gig workers, freelancers, independent contractors who are still getting unemployment benefit, special unemployment benefits, $600, that's going to be gone too on December 31st, right? And people are going to have to, next year, start paying back all the moratorium on their rents, which they're not going to be able to do, right? And then those workers who got their payroll tax deferred by Trump in September are going to have to pay double payroll tax. You know, that was all about putting extra burden on Biden should he win, right? Consumer confidence is plummeting now, once again, right before the holidays when it usually rises. So the fourth quarter is going to look really bad, I think, which will confirm my previous prediction since last March that we're in a W-shaped recovery here, and we're about to have a relapse here in the fourth quarter. Okay. A few comments about what's going on here, you know, with the firings. You know, why is Trump firing Esper, you know, the defense secretary, you know, and others, top civilians in the State Department and in the National Intelligence Services? Why is he firing all these people? What's behind that? Is it just vindictive? You know, this guy Esper refused in June when Trump wanted to call out the regular military to confront the protesters in the cities at that time, you know, Black Lives Matter and in Portland and other places, Antifa and so forth. He wanted to use the military against them. Well, Esper said no. Whoa, you know, Trump didn't like that. And Esper has been refusing to allow Trump to declare the Insurrection Act and use the U.S. military against domestic protesters. Right. So maybe firing him has something to do with that. You know, we're going to have a big demonstration. I think it'll be big, maybe not that big, in Trump supporters in Washington, D.C. tomorrow. You know, Trump would like nothing better than to have clashes in the street between his supporters and, you know, the opposition, you know, Black Lives Matter and Antifa and so forth. More chaos. He wants more chaos, you see. He would like nothing better than that. And he would like to bring in the military. But Esper wouldn't do it. Esper won't do it. And, you know, firing him, does it signal then that he has some plans, Trump, you know, to still bring the military into the picture? Or maybe his plans have to do with going after Iran, right? Creating some sort of military provocation and conflict with Iran here. Create chaos in the foreign policy side as well. Well, you know, why is it, I got to ask this question, why is it the day after he fires Esper, does he send Elliot Abrams to meet with the Saudi princes, you know, and Israel? You know, is there some timing here? Maybe I'm imagining much. But why would he quickly send them at this stage? Not to negotiate anything, right? You know, he's been pumping all kind of military supplies into those countries, particularly the Saudis. You know, what's up with that trip to Israel, right? Or maybe he's going to pull another move, Trump, and recall all the troops from Afghanistan, which Esper is opposed to, too, and is the Pentagon brass. Certainly some more severe sanctions are forthcoming. And then Pompeo has this pissing match on the internet with the head guy over there in Iran, Khamenei, right? They're throwing insults at each other. What is that about? What's going on? You know? Well, I don't know. I don't want to make too much of an October surprise foreign policy war possibility, but, you know, Trump's crazy enough. He could be. Who knows what's really going on there? But there's something going on there, right? Something going on. What about SCOTUS, the Supreme Court, and the upcoming vote here in the Supreme Court on the Affordable Care Act? You know, in 2012, the Supreme Court ruled against the individual mandate. But at the time, it upheld the idea that the mandate was a tax and it was okay to raise taxes to fund Affordable Care Act, right? But, you know, it split its vote in 2012 saying that states have the power only to mandate individuals, not the federal government. So they struck down the mandate, but they upheld the idea that taxes were okay to fund something like this. Right, federal taxes were okay, right? Well, in 2017, when Trump passed his December, his Tax Cut Act, right, they purposely zeroed out, they say, the mandate as part of a tax reform, right? And what's going on now, to make a long legal story short here, is that this issue of tax, mandate, and tax, I think what the Republicans are really trying to do is set up a decision where the Supreme Court upholds the ACA in general, but rules that the taxes must be also levied only state by state, not federally. Yeah. And why is that? Because I'll tell you the number one reason that rich folks and corporations, particularly wealthy individuals, are opposed to the ACA, have been at the beginning, is because it's been partly financed by a 6%+ tax on investment income. Yeah, the rich are just, you know, they hate the fact that they got to pay for the ACA. 6% investment tax. I think it's 6. Maybe it's 3 point something, but it's significant. You know, if you're making millions a year, you know, you're talking about 3%, 6%. You know, you're talking about tens of thousands of extra dollars, maybe hundreds of thousands, just to fund this one program. They hate that investment tax provision in the ACA, and I think they're maneuvering here to get a decision that they can then use to not only repeal the individual mandate as a tax, but repeal the investment tax as a way of financing ACA. Well, we'll see when the decision comes down. A comment here briefly on Pfizer's announcement on the vaccine, right? 90% effective. Whoa, stock market goes crazy, right? Yeah. Now, you got to remember, though, that this isn't your typical vaccine that Pfizer has developed. No, typically a vaccine is a dead virus, the dead virus, or parts of it, proteins of it, you know, injected, stimulates your immune system to fight when you get the real one, right? This is not that. This is a totally new kind of vaccine that goes after those spikes on the coronavirus somehow. But, this is what's important. It requires extreme subtemperatures in order for this vaccine to survive. How extreme? Minus 100 degrees Fahrenheit temperatures, or the vaccine spoils. Minus 100 degrees Fahrenheit. That's pretty damn cold. And therefore, you need special freezers, special super freezers to store this vaccine in. Pfizer says it has 350 of them. Well, you can put 350 of them distributed across the United States, but those are only central distribution locations, right? Somehow you're going to have to get that to a lot of other local distribution. You're going to need super trucks, super freezer trucks. Where are those? We don't have them. And then what do you do when you bring it to the location? How soon does the stuff, you know, the new vaccine spoil? And then you inject people with the spoiled vaccine. What does that do? This is a big distribution problem, you know, because they're talking about, well, we're going to have to set up whole football fields here if you want to mass inoculate people, where people would come, you know, or mass stadiums and stuff like that. It's not going to be your local drive-up thing. Distribution and production, you know, you're going to have to produce this stuff under super freezing temperatures too. So there's some real problems with the distribution of this and the production of this that I don't think they're really talking about right now, right? Now, other companies are trying to develop more typical vaccines where, you know, you take virus vaccines, flu vaccines, where you take, dead parts of the virus. You don't need to super freeze it. This super freezing thing is a big question mark, I think. Anyway, that's my comment on the Pfizer vaccine situation. A brief comment on China trade war. Remember that? A year ago today, Trump announced, whoa, we got a trade war deal with China, right? They're going to buy $100 billion more each year in the next 2 years, $200 billion more of our exports. Boy, it's really going to stimulate the economy, especially the agriculture, his farm base, right? You know, Trump has already given the farm base $70 billion in direct subsidies. $70 billion. Yeah. And one of the reasons why, you know, the economic impact in the farm sector is not as great as it was here this past year in other sectors of the economy. You know, you throw in the fact they opened the economy in the red states early. They got all the stimulus that everyone else got. At the same time, they got $70 billion over the last 18 months, but 20-some billion in the CARES Act and even more being proposed by McConnell. $70 billion. Well, that cushioned the economic impact in those red states. You know, they really weren't in a depression like a lot of the blue states were. Okay, so, $100 billion they were going to buy from us in 2020, right? I think it was something like $36 billion just in agricultural goods, you know, increased spending in agricultural goods, right? Well, you know, let's look at how much has China actually bought up until October. Not $36 billion, $12.7 billion. $12.7 billion, that's it. And that was the Trump China trade deal, as I talked about and wrote about at the time, a flop. They got nothing they really wanted. Well, I take that back. You know, the banks got something. U.S. banks got something. They got a concession by China that they could have 51% ownership. And so did other large corporations if they moved to China. 51. They really control their companies. You know, that's why Tesla building his big plant in China for his cars. You know? That's his solution. Take advantage of it. Yeah. Okay, so, you know, that's the trade war. That's the great trade war. What about Bidenomics here? Well, we don't have a lot of time to get into it, but I'll just say this about Bidenomics. Right, you gotta have to distinguish, and we'll have a show on this, I'm sure, as it becomes clear. You gotta distinguish between his economic program when he's running for office, says whatever he thinks. All politicians do this; will get them votes. It's a marketing program, right? It's a marketing program. It's not what you're gonna see in their economic program, campaign promises. Well, what does he promise? Well, he's going to tweak the Trump $4 trillion tax cuts. I say tweak because, really, For example, the corporate tax was reduced from 35% to 21% under Trump. Well, Biden's going to raise it halfway back to 28, right? Individual taxes, well, he's going to raise it back 2.6%, right? He's going to restore the state income tax deduction that Trump eliminated, et cetera, right? So, you know, some reversal of that, but just tweaking it, really. Social Security, his program during his marketing program was he was going to reduce eligibility to 60 years, right? You can start claiming it at 60 years. Public option and price controls of healthcare costs, okay? That was part of it. A $2 trillion plus stimulus, appointments to the Federal Reserve, infrastructure, big infrastructure spending, right? Going to spend trillions there, including on alternative energy and so forth, and end the trade wars. Well, in reality, I predict this. You know, he's not even going to get his tweaking of the tax cuts with McConnell running the show. Forget about reducing Social Security. They're going to raise Social Security deductibles and raise the eligibility age. You watch, right? And cut SSI eligibility big time. No, forget public option. Dead. Not going to happen. $2 trillion stimulus? No, not going to happen. Infrastructure? Yeah, backloaded. And that was a 10-year program where most of it will not really hit and create jobs in the next couple of years, right? Trade, watch him try to resurrect the PPP program, free trade deal in Asia, okay? So that's what I think is the reality going to be. Now, what you can really see even more clearly is who does he appoint? Who does Biden appoint in the next few weeks? Oh, he really isn't going to appoint until he gets the clearance to do so. But I'm sure they've already picked out people, right? Larry Summers is coming on again. Robert Rubin's coming on again as advisors. You know, these were the guys who convinced Obama, oh, you can't spend more than $787 billion. Yeah, and gave us that weak recovery. By the way, at the same time that we're spending only $770 billion on the rest of the economy, the Federal Reserve is bailing out the banks to the tune of $4 trillion. Yeah, and the same thing's happening now, by the way. Well, but who are they going to appoint? You know, the New York Times had a big spread here just a couple of days ago on the likely candidates here for the departments, right? Department heads. Treasury, forget it. Warren will never get the appointment. Labor, forget it. Sanders will never get the appointment. All right? These will be conservative, pro-business Obama retreads that we're going to see here. Right? Treasury, probably either the Federal Reserve guy, Bostic, African-American. Right? He's a Federal Reserve governor now. Or Janet Yellen again. I probably pick Bostic here, right? State Department, right? I would say probably Chris Coons, right? Chris Coons here from Biden's home state, one of his closest friends, a you know, real corporate guy, has close relations with Senate Republicans, right? So I would say Chris Coons in the State Department. Maybe Susan Rice, but I doubt it. You know, and then Bostic in the Treasury, maybe Yellen. Okay. Injustice, Tom Perez, the head of the Democratic Party here, chairman, right? I bet they put Tom Perez in that role. He's got a Latin last name, right? A concession there. What about defense? Well, that'll probably be either Jay Johnson, right? Black fellow again, right? Who is on the board of Lockheed Martin. Nice connection. Black and a director of Lockheed Martin. Watch him in defense, right? Maybe Michelle Flournoy. Maybe. but I think probably the black fellow, Jay Johnson, with big connections to the military-industrial complex, big corporations, right? And Chris Coons in state and Treasury, probably another black fellow here, Raphael Bostic, a governor at the Fed. Justice, Tom Perez, right? And then we can go down the list here in these other positions. You'll see a lot of women, and you'll see a lot of minority women in a lot of places. So Homeland Security, you know, Val Demings is probably likely. Housing and Urban Development, either Karen Bass, an African-American woman, or Keisha Bottoms, also African-American woman. Health and Human Resources here, well, that's up for grabs. Director of National Intelligence, Lisa Monaco, I would say. Central Intelligence Agency, Michael Morelli. Okay, so watch. Let's watch. Let's see. It's on record here. I said you who told you who I would predict, and we'll see who actually gets predicted or gets selected here, and we'll revisit that in a future show. But it'll become clearer with his appointments. Okay, Bidenomics. We'll have more to say about that as it becomes really clear, and what happens with scorched earth over the next couple weeks. That's it. Alternative Visions on Friday the 13th.